Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Very happy to have you with us this hour. I think you will be very happy that you did join us this hour. We're going to talk a bit about the persecution of Christians in the Middle East. I am Cy Kellett, your host. This is Catholic Answers Live, and it's probably one of the great injustices of our – no, I shouldn't say probably. It is one of the great injustices of our time, the persecution of Christians in the Middle East. Pope Francis, a few years ago, addressed the European Parliament, and he said – that he needed to recall to them the many instances of injustice and persecution which daily affect religious minorities and Christians in particular in various parts of the world. Communities and individuals today find themselves subjected to barbaric acts of violence. They are evicted from their homes and native lands, sold as slaves, killed, beheaded, crucified, or burned alive under the shameful and complicit silence of so many. In places around the world, this persecution certainly continues, but only in the Middle East did it erupt into what we might call a great blaze of violence, even to the extreme of genocide. Our guest this hour is Professor Ronald Rishlak, and he is the Jamie L. Witten Chair of Law and Government at the University of Mississippi School of Law. Professor Rishlak is also the author and co-author or editor of numerous books and articles, among them the definitive book defending Pope Pius XII, his leadership during World War II, Hitler, the War, and the Pope. His current book, edited with Jane Adolph, is The Persecution and Genocide of Christians in the Middle East. Professor Rishlak, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Cy. It's great to be here.
It's a tough topic to undertake, but maybe you could kind of set the stage for us. What are the facts of the case? What do we know about what has happened as in regards to the persecution of Christians in the Middle East?
Right. Well, yeah, it is a tough. I just wrote about a 5 or 6 page summary, and asked my mom who moved down to Mississippi recently to proofread it for me, and she said, you know, this was really shocking, but it's so hard to read because there is a terrible persecution, and much of what the book centers on is whether it amounts actually to genocide, an attempt to eliminate a group of people from an area. The Middle East, in this case, and that group of people being Christians, because we see the beheadings on television. We're aware of the migrants that are trying to escape. We know about the horrors that are taking place. And I had a friend read the first chapter of the book recently, and she turned to me afterwards and said, "Man, I knew they were persecuting Westerners. I didn't realize it was Christians. It was about Christianity." And it is. I mean, there's Middle Eastern people who are Christians, who are being beheaded, who are being driven out, who are being forced to convert at the point of the sword, and many of them, you know, there's the famous scene that we saw about the Coptic Christians kneeling and about to be beheaded because they released that photograph. They all had the option to convert. They didn't. They had their heads chopped off rather than convert from Christianity.
That's it's mind-boggling, and it's apocalyptic, really. I mean, it just has such resonance with the very early decades of the Christian faith.
It absolutely does. And I remember as a young boy, you know, going to Catholic school for a couple of years and going to Sunday school later on and talking about, you know, man, you can't deny Jesus even if someone puts a gun to your head. Then I grew up a little bit older, and that was silly because that's never going to happen. And we live in a world today, fortunately, we live in the United States where it's not happening, but there are segments of the world where that is happening on just about a daily basis.
You note somewhere in the book, and the book, by the way, is The Persecution and Genocide of Christians in the Middle East, that your work with the Holy See and the Holy See's mission to the United Nations was kind of the genesis of this book. Can you say something about that?
Well, sure. Since the year 2000, I have had the honor to work for the Holy See at the United Nations. And, of course, that brought me into a whole new world of international law that I previously didn't know much at all about. my work there has focused on, there's an International Law Commission, and there's also the International Criminal Court. And I've been an advisor to the Holy See's mission on those two areas in particular. And because of that work, I was invited to a conference that took place last year at Ave Maria School of Law in Naples, Florida, where they were looking at international law and whether what was happening to Christians in the Middle East should be designated as a genocide, an attempt to eliminate these people, to kill them or drive them out completely. And that was the focus of the conference, and I was invited because I had this expertise or this involvement at the United Nations. And there really were some phenomenal scholars that were brought together who we got together in this book and presented some of the terrors, the horrible things that are going on, and looking at international law, looking at national law, looking at Vatican diplomacy, trying to figure out what can be done to bring some sort of relief to what's taking place in the Middle East today. And in the book, we present numerous articles, numerous arguments, I should say, and numerous thoughts about how we might approach things. There are no quick and easy solutions here. But the genesis last year, which continues into the book, is whether this can be legally defined as a genocide. And we got to the point after the conference last year, but before the book came out, Secretary of State John Kerry referred to the slaughter as a genocide. Pope Francis had earlier referred to it as a genocide. However, just recently, and by recently, I mean within the past weeks, the legal advisor to the State Department here in the United States has said that was a personal opinion of John Kerry, and it was not, it's not a legal standard. And that's hugely important because if you're committing genocide, international law, national law kicks in to subject the perpetrators to additional penalties, but it also opens up opportunities to provide aid and support to the victims.
Yeah.
And so there's an enormous battle going on right now, and the book is very timely on that matter, and arguing that what's happening truly is a genocide, and the people who are suffering it truly need international support.
And what about folks in Europe, or I shouldn't say folks in Europe, I mean heads of state or foreign ministers in Europe. Did any there make the declaration, a formal legal declaration that this is genocide?
There have been some smaller nations that have referred to it as, but it has not gotten what we don't have is the United Nations endorsement. We don't have the United States. We thought we had the United States. Apparently, we don't have the United States endorsement. And until those two points, you know, come to pass, we're not going to get the world's attention to make it the attention on a case-by-case basis, but you're not going to get the opportunity to open up some of these legal remedies that are there and should be available.
Professor Ronald Rischlach is our guest this hour. The book, The Persecution and Genocide of Christians in the Middle East. If you would like to talk with Professor Rischlach about the book, about the genocide, give us a call, 888-318-7884. That's 888-318-7884. If we're going to say that a thing is genocide, and you say that this is part of the structure of international law, what are we saying is happening? That there's an attempt to wipe out a people?
To completely eliminate a people from an area. And in this case, it's through killing them, converting them, or forcing them to leave. And there's a fascinating twist in Islamic law that is really providing the defense here. There's an option called jizya. In the Quran, there's a reference at one point to people of the book, which would be Christians and Jews, having the ability to pay a tax, a jizya tax, which supposedly, if you pay that tax, although you're not really treated anywhere near the same as a Muslim, you are supposed to be able to carry out your worship and not be subject to the knife, being executed or forced to convert. And so ISIS, in all of the areas it controls, it actually has a magazine it publishes where it boasts about giving the jizya option to the people who live there. But what we have in the book, Naina Shea, who works for the Hudson Institute and is perhaps the most informed person in the nation, at least on this matter, gives us account after account after account where ISIS will put in place the jizya tax, extract all the money that is possible to extract from the people, in the meantime, close all the churches, drive off or kill all of the priests, get all the money, and then turn on the people. I mean, the jizya tax we're talking about in some of the areas would began at a month's salary, an average month's salary, mm-hmm. and it's gone up to 3 months' average salary. And people can't afford it. When they can't afford it, they have to face fleeing or execution or conversion. So the United Nations has basically been taking the word of the ISIS spokespeople and saying, well, you know, it's not really genocide because you have the option to pay this tax, but that's truly a facade. It's not an actual option. No one can afford to pay it, and they're not really being permitted to worship in any case.
888-318-7884 is our number. We're happy to take your calls. This hour we will be discussing the book and the findings of the persecution and genocide of Christians in the Middle East by one of the editors of that book, Ronald Rischlach. We'll be right back after this with more on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers. Our success depends on you.
As legend goes, it was 500 years ago that Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the door of the Wittenberg Cathedral, setting of a series of ruptures that the Church suffers to this very day. Catholic Answers magazine is marking the anniversary with our very special issue delving deep into the Protestant Reformation. Want to be sure to get your copy? Subscribe right now to the best Catholic apologetics magazine anywhere by calling 818-487-2011 or going to Catholic.com. The heroes of the Counter-Reformation, the deadly errors of sola fide, and everything you want to know about how the Reformation played out. Just a few of the articles you can look forward to. Don't wait another moment to subscribe. Call 818-487-2011 or go to the shop at Catholic.com right now to get subscriptions for yourself and those you love. Share the faith. Defend the faith. Catholic Answers Magazine from Catholic Answers. The most trusted name in Catholic apologetics.
Homeschool Connections has recently formed a partnership featuring a dual enrollment program with Franciscan University of Steubenville. Our website is homeschoolconnections.com. We are a proud sponsor of Catholic Answers Live.
This is Tim Staples, and I'm here to tell you about a very special promotion we look forward to every year, our annual store-wide summer sale in the online shop at Catholic.com. This spectacular online event includes savings of 10 to 50% and more in some cases on every book, track, CD, DVD, ebook, and MP3 we carry, including my book on Mary, Behold Your Mother. With lower prices and a great selection, it's by far the best online Catholic sale of the summer. So log on now and all this month to shop at shop.catholic.com and take advantage of our very special prices. You know it's all good stuff because it's from the people you know and trust at Catholic Answers.
Call now with your question. 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
We are talking genocide, a topic that I suppose even just a few years ago, we would have been shocked to think we were talking about the genocide of Christians. But that genocide continues in the Middle East. No reason to be shy about using the word, I don't think, despite the fact that apparently our own State Department has now become shy about using that word. We're discussing that with Ron Rischlach, one of the editors of a brand new book, The Persecution and Genocide of Christians in the Middle East. He is also the author of the definitive book on the leadership of Pope Pius XII during World War II, Hitler, the Pope, and the War, and a book about a former spy chief who reveals secret strategies that for undermining freedom, attacking religion, and promoting terrorism. That book is called Disinformation. And you wrote that book with a man who actually worked as a spy chief in the Eastern Bloc.
That's correct. Jan Mihai Pacepa was the highest-ranking Soviet bloc officer to defect to the West. He ran the foreign intelligence in communist Romania, and there's some fascinating stories that he tells in that book about efforts to undermine the West, undermine the Catholic Church, and try to prove Pope Pius XII was a bad guy when he really wasn't.
He's one of the ones that promoted that, which later turned into that play by Ralph Hawkuth. Is that right?
Well, what we actually reveal in that book is that Hawkuth didn't actually write the play. He took credit as the named author, but it was essentially team written inside the Kremlin.
That's good information to finally have.
It answers so many questions. You know, I've written and talked about Pius XII for about 20 years. That answers so many questions that were hard to figure out up until you realize that this was a scheme from within the Kremlin. Kremlin, by the way, which also we talk about in that book, promoted Islamic terrorism. It kind of fits in with what we're talking about today.
Well, another way that it fits in is there a great deal of dissembling on the part of institutions of the West about what the real horrors of communism were. And that dissembling probably continues today. It seems to we develop these institutions such as the United Nations and the International Criminal Court, but they seem again and again to I suppose paper tiger is the word for it. How effective has the International Criminal Court, very much touted around the world, been in combating the crimes against humanity and the war crimes occurring in the Middle East?
Yeah, so the court's been around now, I guess, getting close to 15 years. I think there have been about three trials that have come to conclusion. It has not been effective. It was in a very foreseeable manner. I think it's been counterproductive in some ways. The International Criminal Court demands that there's always a prosecution. If you've got a tyrant in place, if we've got bad things going on, the ICC, its real reason for being is to make sure that there's not a negotiated settlement that lets the perpetrators of evil get away without punishment. Now, that's fine in theory. You understand that sounds like a good thing. Bad guys must be prosecuted. But what it means in application too often is we have a situation where perhaps we can work out a deal, where perhaps someone will leave office, where they'll stop the reign of terror, they'll quit persecuting people in exchange for the ability, to go live on a mountain or on a beach for the rest of their lives. That's a denial of justice in one way, but on the other hand, it stops the terror.
Yeah.
If you can't use a negotiation, it's the same as the demand for unconditional surrender at the end of a war. You tell the other side, may as well fight to the bitter end because we're not brokering any deals with you.
That was the option Idi Amin took in Uganda, I think. He went and lived in a nice house for the rest of his life, but at least he was out of Uganda.
You get rid of him. Pinochet in Chile left office because he was promised a lifetime immunity. It fell apart later on, but a negotiation can be a tool for peace, and to take it off the table as the ICC does from the very beginning, I think is not wise.
The Persecution and Genocide of Christians in the Middle East. I want to keep saying the name of that book so you can get that book. Ron Rischlak is one of the editors of that book. Before we go to calls, and we do have calls, the line's starting to fill up, so give us a call if you have a question or a comment you would like to make. 888-31-TRUTH is the number, 888-318-7884. Because the institutions of the Western world are often highly secularized, are they ill-equipped to deal with issues that involve frictions that are of a religious nature, even violence that's of a religious nature?
Yeah, that's such a great question, because there comes a point in time, perhaps, we'll speak hypothetically, I think it might be true, but where the bottom line is you've got to face someone and say, your understanding of religion, your understanding of your religion is wrong. that you are misinterpreting things, or you misunderstand nature, you misunderstand God.
Yeah.
I don't think our government can do that. And I think constitutionally we can't do that. Even if constitutionally, if we felt like we could, I think so many of our leaders are not equipped to do anything like that. And so we steer clear from that. And yet we find ourselves in a situation where that's what I think needs to be said and needs to be done. So when Pope Benedict at Ravenswood?
Regensburg.
Regensburg.
Yeah, at the Regensburg lecture, yeah.
Yeah, he gave the famous lecture where he essentially said, there's some serious problems in Islam. And a lot of people got on him and said, well, the Pope can't say that, shouldn't mean that. No, he knew exactly what he was doing.
Right.
He was the voice in the world who at that point could say something that most other leaders don't think they can say. And so I think there's a very important role. We've got a great chapter in the book by John Czarnecki, one of my colleagues and good friends, who talks about Vatican diplomacy in this whole matter, and the important, very important role of the Vatican in trying to broker peace, work out compromises and deals and whatever it takes to assure religious liberty, but to assure life as well.
And we're talking about the genocide, persecution of Christians in the Middle East, and we have lots and lots of calls. I want to make sure we get to them. So we will go to Anonymous, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Anonymous, your question for Ron Rischlach.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Well, what are you guys doing regarding the general population, I mean, Muslim and Christians alike? Because I feel like to solve the problem, you need to liberate the greater population, because even the Muslims that are fighting, I think to them, it feels like they don't understand. If to them, they're probably fighting the allies of the unjust wars that happened a few years ago. So what are you doing to help the general population, including Muslims?
So you're saying, so you want to know about how do you address the problem that Muslims themselves face in the Middle East, and so that the Christian problem is a subset of that. You need a wider social solution. Is that what you're saying, Anonymous?
That's right.
Okay. Ron?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, let's do acknowledge that Muslims are as likely, in fact, more likely to be subject of terrorist attacks than any other population really around the world. And there's lots of attacks against Muslims. The particular impetus of this book was to look at the attempt to eliminate a group of people. There is not, to my knowledge, an attempt to eliminate Muslims from within these areas. This is an effort to purify Islam, to move moderates from the moderate category into a more extreme, more strict version of Islam, and that is problematic. That's something, frankly, is beyond my ability to negotiate and handle. But I'll certainly admit that there are problems that Muslims and by the way, we're not talking in this case. We are talking about Arabs in this case in general. But most of the Christians we're talking about are Arabs as well. So it's not a racial thing. It's we're talking about a religious thing. And non-Muslims, are facing potential genocide.
Anonymous, how does that strike you? No.
Well, sir, I guess you acknowledge it's a bigger problem than just persecuting Christians. So straight enough, I guess I wish there were more activities done to liberate the general population, because I feel like that's a bigger problem. The tyranny of the few that needs to be rightfully so to be removed, like Saddam. But then how do you fill the gap? That's a bigger problem that's creating all these issues. But anyway, thanks for addressing and acknowledging the problem. Thank you.
Anonymous, thanks very much for that call. 888-318-7884, our number. This is Catholic Answers Live. We're discussing the persecution of Christians and, indeed, the genocide of Christians in the Middle East. Ron, we just have a minute before we got to go to a break, so that I'll hold off on the calls for a quick second. But when you look at the international institutions and the pretty gross failures, and then particular individual countries, including our own, many gross failures in protecting these vulnerable populations, How did the Holy See itself do? Like, if you have to give a kind of a grade to the Holy See in standing up and for and defending these folks, how did it
do? That's a great question. I would say that Pope Francis was, I think, if not the first, certainly one of the first world leaders to come out and label what was happening a genocide. The Holy See certainly has worked with all kinds of support and sending people into dangerous areas to try to... There's not an army, so we're not sending soldiers in. And soldiers are important. As Anonymous said, you know, fighting ISIS is actually a very critical part of this matter. To liberate the people. But in terms of what the tools and what is available to the Holy See, I think the church gets an A.
I'm glad to hear that. I had no idea what the grade was going to be. I am glad to hear that. We have a long way to go, though, in lifting the persecution and genocide against Christians in the Middle East. Lots of questions lined up for Ron Rischlach, one of the editors of that book. We'll talk about more of that. Take your calls at 888-318-7884 right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Why does God sometimes reveal himself privately? How does the church discern reports of supernatural miracles and apparitions? What are some of the most famous Marian apparitions in history? And what do they teach us? In 20 Answers, Apparitions and Revelations, you'll find smart, solid answers to these questions and many more, explaining the scriptural and theological basis for private revelation, unpacking the church's approach to evaluating and promoting miraculous phenomena, and sharing inspiring accounts of approved apparitions and revelations from the distant past to the present age. 20 Answers, Apparitions, and Revelations is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com today and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
Want to be able to defend the unborn with confidence? Order your copy of Persuasive Pro-Life, How to Talk About Our Culture's Toughest Issue by apologist and speaker Trent Horn. Available now at Catholic.com.
When you need answers about the Catholic faith, you need to have someone to turn to you can trust. At Catholic Answers, we take that seriously. And at Catholic.com, you'll find the answers to thousands of your questions on all things Catholic with an extensive library of audios, videos, tracks, articles, and more that gets larger every day. We've given the site a whole new look with better navigation than ever before and lots of great new features to make your Catholic.com experience one that will have you coming back again and again. That's Catholic.com with answers from the people you can trust at Catholic Answers. Visit us today.
Hi, this is Cy Kellett. Join me for a show dedicated to Catholic apologetics and evangelization as we connect viewers to prominent leaders in the church today and touch on just about everything relating to the church, from doctrinal issues to family concerns, social issues, evangelization, ethics, you name it.
Catholic Answers Live TV, Friday at 8 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Television.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're giving away to our listeners a chance to download a free copy of that MP3 from Trent Horn and Patrick Madrid when they sign up for the Catholic Answers Live newsletter. All you do is text the word Madrid to 44222 on your cell phone. You get some directions. You follow those directions. You get the free MP3, The Communion of Saints and Purgatory by Trent Horn and Patrick Madrid, two of the finest apologists in the world on one MP3. That's all it takes. Just text the word Madrid to 44222, and we'll send you the instructions on how you can get that. This hour, we're talking about the situation in the Middle East with someone who knows that situation very, very well from the legal side, a lawyer, a professor of law, and a very well received and a much distinguished author, Ron Rischlach. This time, the book is The Persecution and Genocide of Christians in the Middle East, edited by Ron and Jane Adolph. And we've got lots of calls. So, Ron, we just keep going to them?
Absolutely.
All right. Mike in Detroit, Michigan, listening to EWTN on satellite radio. your question for Ron Rischlag.
Hi, I'd like to ask him, don't you think this is just inevitable? If you look at the Quran, certain surahs in the Quran, that this has to happen. Islam has to march on like this. That's their calling. And if you look at the life of Muhammad, the way he was with Christians, Jews, they have to follow his example. In fact, if you, a couple of years ago on the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, the Grand Mufti of Egypt, two of his descriptions of Muhammad in the article was a great political leader and a great military leader. You know, so it's a common, you know, you have these theocracies. I don't know. I just wonder what you think about this. It seems inevitable. They have to do this.
Well, you know, that is a great question and a serious concern. But if we look at the Muslim world, you find 10, 15, it's a large absolute number, but it's 10-15% who read the Quran that way, that it's necessarily militaristic. Some and you know, I feel awkward saying this, but some of our very best friends that we've known here in Oxford for 30 years are Muslims and are nice people, and I've talked to them about this, and they read the Quran a different way. They understand it a different way, as do the vast majority of Muslims in the world. In fact, if you want to focus on sort of the why, wherefore from the terrorism and such that exists, there are Muslims all around the globe. The terrorism and what's happening bad is almost all in the Middle East. There is a geographic component to it. It's not strictly from the Quran, from the faith. And if I tap a little bit into my book, Disinformation, I work with Pacheco on, that's exactly where the Kremlin, the Soviets, fomented anti-Semitism and tried to create a violent brand of Islam to use against the United States and the United States' ally, Israel. So there's some linkage that way as well. It's not inherent with everyone who reads Islam, but it's widespread, certainly far too widespread in the Middle East.
Mike, does that answer satisfy you?
Well, I'm not saying terrorism has to happen, but even if you look at moderate Muslim countries like Indonesia, even if they have elections, they have to be Islamic. They're basically theocracies, and they always have been.
Well, they are theocracies. You know, I mean, the concept of the Quran being the law, I mean, that's true. Yeah, that is correct.
Mike, thank you very much for that call. We have a whole bunch to get to, so I'm going to keep moving. We go now to Terry in Tacoma, Washington, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Terry, your question for Ron Rischlag.
Yes, hi, Ron. I'm wondering, do you have any particular recommendation for how to help, like specific groups? Because there's so many out there who say they're helping, and just wondering if, you know, specifically,
yeah, no,
there's a way we can make
that's,
a difference.
That's a really good question, and I should have had something right at my fingertips. I will say Nina Shea, who works with the Hudson Institute, is one of our contributors, and they do a lot of great work. Bob Destro, a law professor at Catholic University in D.C., another contributor, does a lot of work with the Knights of Columbus, and the Knights have been very much out front doing a lot of great work over there with that. There are some other groups as well, but, you know, I would say I personally would go with Knights of Columbus because that's what I am, but you could look up Nina at the Hudson Institute as well.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Terry, thank you very much. It's also true, isn't it? And I know you're okay. So you're pushing the Knights because you're a knight. But the Knights of Columbus, had they not done what they exerted tremendous pressure and well organized, efficient, effective pressure on the U.S. government to even get Secretary Kerry to admit personally now that there was a genocide going on, and they've been really at the forefront of focusing.
And Bob Destro, who wrote the second chapter in this book, was the point man for the Knights of Columbus on that matter. You're absolutely correct. And that's why it was so important. Bob's a good friend of mine, but I felt like I had to beg him to get him to get his chapter done. I hounded him and hounded him, but he turned in a truly outstanding chapter for the book.
So, yeah, take a look at the Knights of Columbus, and if you're looking for an organization to support. And I would just also commend you to We have an eparchy right here in San Diego, eparchy being the word for diocese for Chaldean Catholics. You might look into supporting them in their efforts to support individuals in refugee camps and whatnot. You know, let me take that as an opportunity to ask you about, if I can, Ron, about refugee camps and how Christians are being treated in refugee camps.
Well, that's another one of the points that shocked me. You don't think about this, right? So the people get run out of their town. They get their money extracted from them through the jizya tax, or maybe they leave before they've got lost all their money. But they have to go through ISIS checkpoints where property is confiscated, money's confiscated. It's sweltering hot a lot of times going through the desert. You're on foot because they've taken your cars and vehicles away. And then you get to a refugee camp, and you go in there, and the Christians once again are discriminated against, and there are horrific accounts of rapes and of attacks and of beatings and muggings and things like that, because they're a minority within the minority as well. So you find the situation then where a lot of Christians will skip the camps, not go to the camps, leaving themselves exposed to other dangers along the way. So when we look at the numbers of in terms of the number of refugees accepted into the United States last year, I'm speaking off the top of my head, it was something like 10,000 refugees were taken in, and it was less than 1% were Christian, even though the areas they were being drawn from were 10 to 15% Christian, and Christians were the ones being particularly right. discriminated against. Yep. So you'd think, if anything, you would tilt to be above the percentage of population.
That's why I recommend people look into helping Chaldean Catholics, because they know individuals. You know, these are families that are that they can identify who is in fact Christian, who is in fact facing persecution and in need of assistance. So Knights of Columbus, the Chaldean Eparchy, both places to look. I wonder about if you would say something. We've talked about so many institutions and either their failures or their successes. It does seem that the country of Jordan has been helpful to the refugees.
Well, that's absolutely true. The ability, being close, being able to accept people in, creating opportunities for them, those are wonderful things. If you look around the Middle East, there are way too many countries that have not been open to the refugees. And I'm not saying you have to turn yourself into Germany, where you're essentially promising money and you got people passing through other safe areas just to keep going. But when there are real people fleeing Syria, and it's the photograph. One thing, I'll stop just for a moment here. The book, The Persecution and Genocide of Christians in the Middle East, has 28 photographs. We put them in kind of at the last minute. I said, you know, there's some really good stuff we should use here. And we very quickly found just some stunning photographs that show the horrors of people fleeing, of people, what they're fleeing from. Some actually very nice, you know, children playing in rubble. You know, they're finding joy even in these horrific situations. But you got people leaving areas like that, and when people really need help like that, there need to be places where they can go. And too many nations in the Middle East have closed their doors completely. Bordering nations, close nations, but Jordan has been much more helpful along those lines.
Let's go to Mark in Sacramento, California, listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. Oh, no, I'm sorry. We don't have Mark. Well, let's take a quick break. I don't know what happened to Mark. Just at the very moment I'm trying to get to him, he decided to leave us. We'll take a break. We'll be right back with more with Ron Rischlak on the persecution of Christians in the Middle East.
Your questions, Catholic answers, live.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? The good news is that now there is. Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking new resource by apologist Trent Horn, that one book you can hand to anyone as a starting point for helping them find their way into or back to the practice of the Catholic faith. Don't miss out on the most important, life-changing book to come along in years. Order your copies of why we're Catholic today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Pope Francis said, "All of us are called to mature in our work as evangelizers. We want to have better training, a deepening love, and a clear witness to the gospel. St. Paul Street Evangelization's online School of Evangelization will equip you with the tools you need to be an effective evangelist. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you're unable to give, we'll set you up for free. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Matthew 13, Jesus spoke of a sower who sowed some seed that fell on the path, and the birds came and ate it up. Some fell on rocky ground with little soil. It sprang up quickly, but was scorched by the sun. Thorns choked some as it grew. But some fell on rich soil and produced fruit of 100 or 60 or 30-fold. Whoever has ears, he said, ought to hear. In other words, whoever has the rich soil of an open mind and heart ought to understand what he was saying. Undoubtedly, there were some there whose attitudes were choked by the thorns of self-interest, or whose superficial interest was shallow of the soil of sincerity. Most of us lack the adequate requirements for his love to flourish in us at one time or another, but he doesn't give up on us. Good Friday shows us how much he wants us to hear him. Whoever has ears ought to hear. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
The title of the book we're discussing this hour is The Persecution and Genocide of Christians in the Middle East. A tough read, but a very important read. Also, it's not all just tough. It's very enlightening. You can't help but learn. And we were just talking on the break. It comes with a glossary at the back of terms, and it's very helpful. I hadn't realized. You said you just put that in last minute, Ron.
Yeah, as I mentioned, I when I get ready to publish something, I got my wife, got my mom, I got other. My mom said there's terms in here I'm not familiar with. You need a glossary. And I talked to the publisher, and it was 3 days before going to print. And he said, yeah, we need a glossary. And so I put together a glossary.
And it's like a glossary of all those words that you hear in news stories or whatever, and you're like, what is that? And then there it is. So
yeah, you almost could use it just for reading news stories a lot of times.
Right.
So you understand what's going on.
We go now to Joe in Boston, Massachusetts, listening on the Stations of the Cross. Joe, your question for Ron Rischlach.
Yes. My question bears upon the moral responsibility of the United States to take the lead in taking in these Christian refugees and persecuted people. And I say that specifically with reference to the Iraq War of 2003, which Pope St. John Paul II explicitly condemned in early 2003 as an unjust war because it was not a war of last resort. When you consider that Iraq was a peaceful, stable country in 2003, and that as a result of this war, initiated by the U.S., that it created the conditions under which ISIS was able to come about. Don't you think that the United States has a special moral responsibility to take in these people?
That's an interesting thought, Joe. It's Saddam Hussein, was in fact a butcher, and things were horrible under him. But when the United States took him out, and you're right, Michael Novak went on behalf of President Bush to sort of seek the blessing of the Pope, and the Pope would not give his blessing because it was an anticipatory war. Iraq had not launched an attack on anyone. I think the poor planning that came in that matter was there was an assumption that there'd be sort of a liberation like we saw at the end of World War II, and the people would rise up and establish a new democracy. Instead, there was somewhat of a vacuum, and you have al-Qaeda and you have terrorists sort of take over. So it was there was a poor planning for post-war after Saddam was ousted. Does that leave the United States in a particular? I mean, I suppose you can argue that. I think that the United States always takes a lead on matters like this, and what they did at that time, in fact, you know, was taking a lead, and there were theologians who wrote strongly, arguing that it was what was necessary to do because of the brutal way that Saddam Hussein was running his nation. But what we've seen thus far is the United States has been criticized for not taking as many refugees as some other nations have, although President Obama took more last year. As I mentioned, however, earlier, there was not the number of Christians you might expect. President Trump earlier this year talked about increasing the number of Christians and perhaps giving them at least up to, you know, the percentage of population. So, you know, maybe we will rectify some of that. We ended one really bad situation, but ended up creating another one as well.
Joe, I'm
okay. I understand. I just feel that there are many repressive dictatorships in the world, and that by conducting this war, which does not at all meet the criteria for a just war as articulated by St. Augustine, I think we created a much worse situation than existed. And I just feel that we should, as a country, take upon ourselves the moral responsibility to do all that we can to take these people in. And that's really all I want to say. Thank you.
Joe, thank you very, very much for that call. We appreciate it. 888-318-7884. The number. We go now to Al in Willow Grove, Pennsylvania, listening on Holy Spirit Radio. Al, your question for Ron Rischlach.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And I would like first to agree with the previous caller about the moral responsibility. Because, by the way, I'm a Caribbean Christian who lived most of my life in Iraq. And I know what is it like to persecute, the persecution of Christians and other religious minorities that are non-Muslims. So my question, which is, I think I heard your guest saying that it's particularly mostly a Middle Eastern problem. My question is that, are there any, like, inherent and systematic problem in Islamic theology? And this is from early Islam. I would say that I'm educated on Islam even more than the average Muslim, or even the average Christian. I read and I listened to, I would say, tons of people and Muslim scholars from oral texts. Are there inherent systematic teachings in Islamic theology and jurisprudence that will lead directly or indirectly to the persecution of non-Muslims? I'll give you a couple examples, like in Egypt. Could be a love story between, I know it's not in the theology or jurisprudence.
Wait, hang on, Al. We lost you for just a quick minute there. So, Al, I just need to get you to a point real quick here. So you did all that study. In your view, is it a yes or a no that in Islam there is an inherent theological a tendency towards the persecution of non-Muslims? Was that a yes or a no?
Yes, clearly yes. From early time, from the first and second century. And you said only Middle East. How about even in Philippines? Or go to the so-called modern Islamic states, like Philippines, where there are like a Muslim majority.
Okay. Al, thank you. It's just really hard to hear you, and I want to make sure we're moving along. And Ron, you had said earlier, I think the position you left was that it's an open question, that we need this answered, but I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Yeah, I think what Al was saying is earlier I did say that we see terrorism coming out of Muslims in the Middle East, but we don't see the same level of terrorism when we look at Asian Muslims or elsewhere around the world. The Philippines, there's been a recent influx of ISIS-related immigrants, I believe, and we are seeing a little more terrorism there. But my point is, it's not that terroristic tendencies and this kind of persecution exists everywhere where we see Islam. We see pockets of it. We see places of it. And I did say that it was cultivated somewhat in the Middle East by my co-author and other folks working out in the behest of the Kremlin from the 1950s into the 1980s.
Al, if I may ask you, given what you've said, do you foresee a future? So you're an Iraqi Chaldean Catholic. Is there any? Is it likely that Chaldean Christians who have come here from Iraq, for example, will ever go home or will ever return?
No, it's very unlikely. And I'm one of the refugees because, you know, we need, like, to change the culture. There needs to be a real reformation in Islam, which is, like, unforeseeable so far because, you know, like, the teachings I'm talking about, you can't criticize one religion. You can't criticize not only the prophets of Islam, certain figures in Islam, many figures. You can't criticize the teachings. So any silly stuff like a love story between a Christian and Muslim could inflame a whole village or a town. And with all due respect to the guest, like he said, so go to Nigeria, go to Ethiopia and certain places. Okay, the problem is that where the traditional teachings, the early developed theology and jurisprudence from the second century, and even if you go to the life of Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, you see many accounts that support these teachings. It's a very early, it's something like when we talk about early church fathers. So how non-Muslims are seen under Islamic rule?
Again, so, Al, I'm not trying to cut you off at all. It's just that apparently there's a hurricane or something going on there in Pennsylvania, and I get in the house or get down in the basement. It sounds like the hurricane is approaching and getting closer. But I wanted to ask Al that, and he says he doesn't think people will go back. Do you have a sense of that, Ron? Is the situation so ruptured and devastated that there is no future for Christians in Iraq or in that part of the Middle East?
Well, I think the people who leave are going to be reluctant to go back. I wouldn't say that Christianity is through in those areas. By the way, now I would want to mention chapter 3 in our book by Robert Festighi, who teaches a seminary, I believe, in Michigan. He has chapter 3, Historical and Theological Reflection on the Persecution of Christians. This goes back through the ages, talks a lot about the things our caller was asking about, and goes through, what you find in the Quran, how it has been understood across the years, how some people read these matters and see them as a need to persecute, but how others have not read it that way throughout history. It's, you know, I mean, Catholics, Protestants, Christians, we've read our Bible differently in different ways as well today. You know, I mean, it's maybe not the extreme difference that we're seeing in Islam right now, but there are different ways to interpret writings.
We're trying to move quickly to continue with these calls. We go to Trooper in Marble Falls, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio.
Hey, Si, you're doing a good job. And Ron, you are an angel, man, bringing us this report. I mean,
he's not quite an angel. He's like, the father of six children, and angels cannot do that. But
I appreciate the thought, though.
A messenger of peace, then.
Amen, brother. But, so, your question for Ron was?
Aside from the Knights of Columbus doing a call to arms, do we go to our congressmen, or what do we do?
Well, it seems to me that we could get a situation where maybe we have Congress do that, where we let our politicians know that we want this designation. President Trump has referred to it as a genocide, and it's one of those things that I suppose that he might do again. He was much more willing to use the term genocide than President Obama ever was. So, you know, maybe we'll get it that way. I was quite astonished, and within the last 2 weeks, when the State Department, there was an article I think I read 2 days ago that said they're going back through all their old documents and deleting the word genocide wherever it had been used, and that's problematic. We don't need to backtrack on that, and hopefully, some of the folks who are. We've talked about author chapters in this book are involved in that fight, trying to make sure that doesn't happen.
Trooper, thank you very much for that call. And Ron, you may not be an angel, but we really do appreciate all the work that you have done, both in defense of Western civilization, particularly in the person of Pope Pius XII, and now in defense of the Christians of the Middle East. And thanks for being with us for this hour.
Well, so I certainly appreciate it. I love listening to you, and keep up the great work yourself.
Thank you very much. The book, again, The Persecution and Genocide of Christians in the Middle East, edited by Ron Rischlack and Jane Adolph. And you can get that from Angelico Press. So maybe that's why he thought Ron was an angel. Angelico Press. And tomorrow, 2 hours of open forum. Any question you've got on the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church, we're happy to take it. We'll see you then, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.